Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Skullcast, the premier podcast about Berserk from the community at skullknight.net. I am your eternal host, Walter, and joining me today for episode 161 is Aziel.
The eternal guest. Hey, everybody.
Yeah, that's true. Eternal guest, damn it. Eternal side, what is it, sidecar? And when you're a little motorcycle thing?
Yeah, the sidecar.
I feel bad putting you in the sidecar. Maybe I should be in a sidecar.
I'm the sidekick. I'm Robin to your Batman.
Yeah. And if it's Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, you're Sean Connery and I'm Indy?
I guess, yeah. Or I could also be the little kid, the Asian kid. I forgot his name.
No, that's the second movie. He's not in the third.
Yeah, I know he's in the second movie. And the third movie is that'd be Sean Connery, obviously.
Yeah, well, and okay, in Last Crusade, they do have a sidecar moment.
Like, oh, yeah, that's what you meant. Yes, indeed, yes.
I think it's separated because they're fighting the Nazis and something. I don't really remember. Yeah. I was like 10 when I saw that.
I know he uses his umbrella to scare birds and take down a German plane on the beach.
That's true. Of course he did. I mean, they got the same guy escape from the rock. You know he's got some tricks up his sleeve, you know?
Yeah.
Is he still alive? Is he dead?
Is he dead? Yeah, he's dead.
Okay. I mean, that's what I expected.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he was a great actor, but why are we talking about this again?
Sidecars, I don't remember.
You know, sidecars, motorcycles, a pursuit. It's kind of like the covered wagons being pursued through the woods by trolls in this episode.
You're going too quick.
Yeah.
We'll get there. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. We're back. We don't have any news to discuss. Aziel and I actually reviewed the news and the lack of news. There's nothing really to talk about. I would love to talk about Berserk news. There's no Berserk news. So... moving on to the main event, which is, of course, wrapping up our reread of Volume 37, which is, I intentionally split up this volume into three, because it does have three neat chunks, and this final chunk is just two episodes long. It's our introduction to Falconia through the lens of Rickert and Erica. So that's what's on order today, and I'll go ahead and get started. Before I get into the summary, I do realize there's a little bit to say about this little chunk, and that is these two episodes came out in 2012, I think it was, and these are the last two episodes released before Miura took a historically long break from Berserk to work on and release Gigantomachia, which came out, was it the 20th anniversary or the 30th anniversary of Young Animal?
No, it's 20th. I'm stupid. 20th. It's Young Animal started in 92. So this one right. In 2012, so it is 20 years.
If you don't know about Gigantomachia, you should check it out. It's, of course, a totally separate series from Berserk, a science fiction series that he released in 2012 as kind of a way of celebrating Young Animal's 20th anniversary. Super unique. I love it to death. Well, I eventually loved it to death. I didn't like the first issue or so. I thought it was kind of like fine. I really got into it by the end. Worth checking out. I'm sure we'll discuss it on this podcast again in the future.
Actually, it's 2013 and beginning of 2014.
Because he took off 16 months from Berserk to work on that.
Yeah.
And then we didn't see Berserk for a while is the whole reason of this little aside here is there was a long break and people were starting to get a little flustered about that break, as I recall. But it really had nothing to do with the content of the series. The series was, I mean, this is an amazing section of Berserk. I mean, it's honestly, I say this a lot, but it's one of my favorites and it's one I think about a lot, which is, of course, our first real blush with the inside of Falconia. We saw a little peek over its walls previously in episode 307, back in volume 35, I guess, technically 35, 34. But this is our first, like, going inside the city and seeing what life is like, what the culture is like, what the civilization is that Griffith has established within Falconia. So the episode begins with mine, which is called episode 332, Covered Wagon. The episode starts with a relentless action sequence. A caravan of wagons is being chased by trolls through a forest. Just as the trolls get close, a repeating crossbow fires on them. It's Rickert and Erica. She's feeding it with arrows until the bowstring breaks. The remaining trolls are catching up, so Erica uses some caltrops or spiked balls, but those only slow down a few of the trolls. It's hopeless until arrows are shot by an archer from the trees and they rain down from the sky. Then knights led by Raban, waving the flag of the Band of the Falcon, appear and storm through the forest to rescue them. Rickert warns them that there's still something else lurking in the forest, which soon reveals itself as a cockatrice. Its breath causes men to become paralyzed, and it's about to munch on a knight when the mysterious archer shoots it in the eye. He leaps down, revealing himself as Irvine. His arrow is intercepted by the cockatrice's breath, and he has to leap to escape it. Irvine tosses his hat to Raban, holds out his bow, and transforms into his apostle form, firing a single arrow into the cockatrice's mouth, saying, "You are my prey, you will not escape." That's the summary. First and foremost, it's really good to see Rickert and Erica back again and surviving in this new world. It has been a long time since we saw them. I think it's volume 22. Was there any peek at them since volume 22? I can't remember any.
I don't think so.
Which is a little bit more than 10 years in our time, and it's about 15 volumes in Berserk time. So a long, long time. And I really like that Mira chose them. I think it's a really cool choice to be our lens into life within Falconia as we go forward. That's not for these episodes. That's for the next few episodes. It's something that I actually had guessed at a year or so before it happened. I was just thinking, hey, during this break, hey, it's been a long time since we saw Rickert. I wonder what's going on with him. And I was like, we don't know much about Falconia, and he still has this relatively unresolved thing with Griffith from the Hill of Swords. I wonder what he'll do. I wonder if he'll be kind of funneled to Falconia because of the state of the world. And that is what ended up happening, which is, it's cool. And again, it's not me patting myself on the back. It's just that I like the idea, and it's cool to see the idea brought to life in a way that I could never have envisioned. So I think that's very cool. The other big thing about this episode to me is it shows the integration of humans and apostles into a fighting force to protect humans, which is, of course, a totally new concept for this world. And it very quickly establishes the state of the world and Falconia's place in the world. So, you know, the presumption here is that we are in an outlying area, somewhere near Falconia, but still on the border, right? And there are humans that are escaping and trying to find safety from the terrible place that they're living in. And they stumble into the midst of an apostle who's protecting them from creatures, and of course the Band of the Falcon, which are here to ferry humans to safety into Falconia's walls. So all of that is very, very new stuff for this world. It shows what Falconians have been up to, which we had wondered about. Like, what, now that they've got their capital, what will happen next? What's going to be the next step beyond just having a paradise within its walls? You know, we see that they are not just within its walls, but also spreading outside the walls, trying to make a safe passage through this new wilderness.
Yeah, and it also gives us a subjective point of view down on the ground of Fantasia, what it's like. And that's one thing I like about this episode, is I think it's extremely well-crafted. It's very economical in terms of storytelling, and really it's even perfect, I would say, because it opens mid-action, and the first panel sets the scale. You know, we got these giant trees, so we know it's not a normal forest. It's not Kansas anymore. The wagons are being pursued by trolls, which are both familiar, but also help underline that we are in a different world now. We show Rickert's engineering, his ingenuity, that it helps, but isn't enough. So just in these 8 pages before Irvine intervenes, it very effectively encapsulates the struggles that all humans would endure in Fantasia, even competent people like Rickert. It's a great contrast with, for example, how Gat's group can go through things. And having Rickert and Erica there, of course, it grounds things too, because these are characters we care about. And then Irvine intervenes, Raban's troop arrive, so that immediately changes the dynamic of the scene. They're bearing Griffith's flags, which informs us also on who's ruling the show and sets up expectations for Rickert down the line. Because Raban, like, historically was not a member of the Band of the Falcon. Now he bears that flag because Griffith is the de facto ruler of the place.
And he subsumed all the armies.
Exactly. And then, so you've got these reversal of the situation. And again, in very short amount of pages, and it's not over yet, then a new monster, a cockatrice, makes its appearance, and that reverses the situation once more. The soldiers are no match for it. So then Irvine not only needs to intervene, but has to transform. And we end with that face-off. So just in one episode, we've got all these things that even show us that, for example, an apostle not transformed, even one of Irvine's status, is not enough to take care of one of the random monsters in this forest. So it's a lot of information, a lot of stuff going on in one episode, and it's also an action-packed episode. So that really shows us, I think, the masterfulness of Mura's storytelling, basically, because it's really, really well executed. And we got more of that, of course. You mentioned Rickert and everything that's going on with, of course, the Band of the Falcons, the expectations with Griffiths. There's also Erica, for example, which is shown to be resourceful and gutsy, quick thinking, acts in the moment, tough girl. And I think of that because obviously, as we've seen in the continuation recently, her character is not depicted like that. And that's the kind of character she is. So even for a character, I would say minor, like Erica, even more minor than Rickert, we still got this characterization that's consistent throughout. So it's a lot of stuff in one episode. I really love it because of how well-crafted it is.
Yeah, you mentioned it, but I wanted to focus on it quickly, which is that Irvine, the cockatrice is not an immediate pushover for even someone like Irvine.
Yeah.
He has to transform, which is exactly the kind of thing I wanted to see. With this new world was exactly how apostles stack up, because there's a range of different types of creatures. There's, you know, things that will sweep your chimneys or your rooftops. There are elves. There are specters. There are, you know, there's a ton of different creatures. Well, how do apostles fit in that mix? You know, and here we see something like the cockatrice. It's not something just a standard apostle form can take out, or a human apostle form. They have to transform to be formidable against them. We see Irvine kind of leap out of the way of the paralyzing mist, which is a cool little thing. Even he has to be a little bit on his toes when he's fighting these things.
He does the same exact leap than he does on the roof of Windham when Ganishka strikes him in volume 27. Mm-hmm. I really like that detail, that it's the exact jump. It's like that's his way of jumping, and it's not just random. It's something Mura kept consistent between the two. I really love that. But to stick to the cockatrice a little bit, I really love that design that Mura did. Of course, it's a very classical fantasy monster. Actually, not a fantasy monster, more of a mythological monster, because it's from Roman mythology originally. So I just love how it's done. It's just fucking huge. Basically, it's just a huge rooster that's got that paralyzing breath, and just it for a throwaway monster. I don't know. I think it's just cool. It's funny. I don't know. I find it funny. Just the idea of a giant chicken makes
I don't know, man. Roosters are scary. They could be scary.
Yeah,
even small ones could be scary. So a giant one is very scary.
Yeah, they can be aggressive. I mean, they were once the emblem of France. So
no, really.
Yeah, for real, of course. Long story, but I think someone had made fun of the French king, saying he was ruling on kind of a chicken. I forgot who you would say it in English, but basically comparing him to a rooster, and so he made the rooster his emblem.
Oh, wow, he embraced it.
Yeah, cool. Some kind of like, yeah, fuck you, so what? So we do have that that old thing as a symbol of, the animal symbol of France from the old times, yeah.
Two more things with this Irvine versus cockatrice is that when Irvine finally lands, you know, he gets one in the eye. Oh, sorry, one of them. He gets his eye.
Yeah.
Then he fires again, but the cockatrice blows the arrow down, so it has no effect, which takes Irvine a little bit off guard. And that's when he realizes he needs to take it seriously. He takes his hat, throws it to Raban. Look after my hat, he says. And then holds his bow up to begin the transformation. So The visuals here on this, actually, the previous, like, let's just say four pages, there's two standout visuals in this episode to me. The first is, of course, the two-page of the cockatrice reveal, which I love that Rickert knew it was coming. I like this, the way this unfolds is, you think the trolls are the danger. The trolls, the pressure gets relieved as soon as the trolls are slashed by the falcons on horses, or the band of the falcon on horses. But you think, oh, they think it's over. But actually, Rickert then says there's still one more thing hiding, coming through the trees. And you see this giant rooster. So the way the scene kind of like ebbs and flows and then like crescendos as soon as a cockatrice appears, I like that flow a lot. The visuals are great. But my favorite visual, though, I'm tempted to say it's the two-page spread of Irvine fully transformed, pulling the bowstring back. Well, that is a very technical shot. Like, I love how the overlay of the apostle form occludes this like what is it, side view of his face on the lower left. That's very cool. My favorite, though, is the transformation itself. These, like, long vertical panels on the previous page where you see his, like, the mist or the fire, whatever. I'm assuming it's mist is the effect.
Yeah.
Of him transforming with the eye, the focus being on the eye of the bow. It's just very, very cool.
Yeah, I agree. That's also my favorite part. The preceding page where you see him without his hat holding the bow, then the effect starts from the eye of the bow, and then that page... that's also my favorite part. It's really nicely done. And so that's something we hadn't seen in Volume 34. We see him transformed already. We don't see a transformation. Right. So to be able to see the process was very nice.
Yeah. New info. Throughout that transformation process, there's two reaction scenes or shots of Rickert and Erica. But Rickert recognizes what he's seeing. You know, he doesn't finish his statement, but he says that's a, you know, the implication is he knows this is an apostle.
Yeah.
And he's wondering what that means, which of course will get addressed in the next episode. So the last page is, of course, the arrow going into the cockatrice's mouth, and we know what's going to happen next because we all remember what happens when an arrow goes from Irvine's bow. What happens next?
Well, I mean, we don't quite know because the cockatrice might have able to deflect it. So it's and technically it's a cliffhanger.
Yeah, of course. It is blowing its the breath right then too. So, yeah.
It's stinking breath that smells so bad people can't move.
Which is very similar to apostles, really, when apostles can paralyze humans in a similar way.
I would guess, I would say they're so evil that people are shocked, you know. Mm-hmm. All right, then I guess I'll move on to the next one.
Yep, all yours.
So next episode is Paradise. As an apostle, Irvine completely outmatches the cockatrice. His arrows go through its breast and instantly kills it. He then removes the tree blocking the way and the soldiers and the caravan head towards the city. While he saves them, he gives an air that frightens Erica and prompts Rickert to think about Griffiths and the way the world has changed. As they head on, a few harpies attack, which Rickert successfully dispatches with his bowgun. Irvine takes note of it from afar, and so does Raban, but he goes up to them to congratulate him. Rickert recognizes him and reveals that he was once part of the Band of the Falcon himself. They talk about the ways the world has changed and come out of the forest to see a transformed landscape. Giant crystals puncture the land, which repel monsters. In the distance, a giant tree towers above everything else, which they call the World Spiral Tree, and it creates bountiful harvests year-round all around the city. The caravan and soldiers join other streams of refugees as they near what was formerly Windham and is now Falconia, mankind's only bastion in this world where humans can live as humans. So it's a slower episode, less action, but very dense as far as the number of information we get. Of course, we've got gorgeous artwork. I mean, I love the two-page spreads. There's one of the wingstones, there's one of the harvests, one of the tree, even the panel in the forest that's reminiscent of a Kryphos where you see the little creatures in the darkness. Very nice. And of course, the intro with Irvine's final shot to the cockatrice it looks great. So yeah, a lot of information given in a casual manner. There's especially the tree's properties and the wingstones, which we'll talk some more about later. Beyond that, we get more development for Rickert. We learn that he wanted to go to Griffiths during the war against the Kushans, but he didn't because of Erica, so that's an interesting parallel with Guts, albeit in a very different manner, because Rickert was more curious to see what was going on and wanted to see Griffiths. We also get an interesting line about Griffiths that comes up a few times in the story, the fact he's different from before and yet feels more like himself somehow. So that's a great way to emphasize that he's been recreated as some sort of idealized, magnified version of himself. He's not human anymore. Rather, he's more like a legendary version of himself. So this is, of course, also shown in the way Murat depicted him in the story, always with some kind of dreamy aura about him, some inscrutable look. We don't know what he thinks. So, but yeah, I like the fact that it's put on paper here. And it's done a few times. I think Guts has an almost similar thought about him. But yeah, I wanted to clarify that. And because I know sometimes people are like, well, Didn't they say he looks exactly the same? So why does he look different? And no, it's not like that. It's really that he doesn't look the same, but somehow he looks even more like Griffith than before. It's because really there's that
idealized, yeah.
Yeah, that idea of being idealized. So that was interesting to me. And of course, interesting to see harpies, which like hydras are from Greek mythology. And like I mentioned earlier, the cockatrice, it's from, it originated in the Roman Empire, basically from Pliny the Elder. So I think these monsters are not placed there randomly. And I talk about the hydra because we saw it, same with the harpies, when Fantasia was revealed. It's because these, to me at least, they subtly evoke Geyseric's time from 1,000 years ago. These are, you know, compared to like more medieval style monsters, like trolls, which are more from Nordic folklore. These evoke a time that was a bit before, you know, Greek, Roman, and that kind of parallels Geyseric's time. So I think that's on purpose. I don't know what you think, Walter.
I had never thought about that before because, you know, they're all in one bucket to me, fantasy creatures. I don't necessarily divvy them up based on when they were originally ideated, but that is actually, to me, I think that is an intentional thing, a tip of the hat somewhat to the state of the world before everything we know settled in.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you agree. And I guess that's about all I had. Of course, beyond that, there's the tree and the wingstones, but what are your thoughts on the episodes beyond that? I mean, before we talk about that.
Well, I wanted to talk about something that I'd not quite thought about before, what you mentioned, which is about Rickert hearing about what's happening with the band of the Falcon and him initially feeling like he wanted to go out there to see it himself, which feels like causality. Like it feels like it's something driving him to go take an action, but he didn't take that action because of Erica. He has something to protect. It feels like, I don't know. It feels like, Erica got in the way of the purpose. You know what I mean?
Huh.
The purpose being that Rickert would ally himself with Rickert, or sorry, with Griffith. I always do that. In much the same way that Mule did, you know, Mule, whenever he prostrated himself before Griffith, I could picture myself an alternate version of Rickert doing that, you know, but, he didn't. He didn't go out there. He didn't submit himself out there because he had to stay away from those kind of conflicts. He had something to protect.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's just a stray thought.
Yeah, it's a kind of a complex question because Rickert, there is a thing where he knew Griffith from before and he had that close-up knowledge of him. Like, he knew who he really was versus just, like, Raban seeing him from time to time. So I wonder, really, if they had a plan like that versus him just having that drive to the curiosity. So it's an interesting question. But in any case, he did end up going there in the end. And we'll talk about that later, of course.
For sure.
Go ahead.
The other thing is the symbol that Rickert holds up. You know, this, of course, plays a role later at the very end of this sequence. Or not the very end, close to the end of the sequence. But the design of it is different. And is it too much to talk about that now, or should we wait till like next volume?
That's a good question because it comes up big time at the bridge, and I guess
we'll wait for it. We can wait for
it. Yeah, we can wait for it because it is very telling. It's a very loaded thing, so I guess it could wait. But it is
okay.
I mean, it kind of goes into what I was saying earlier. Griffiths, Rickert was a member of the... You see, I'm like you. I said mix the two.
Yeah, Rickert, I don't know what it is. They're not even phonetically that similar.
Yeah, it's. I'm sure there's something like in the way the brain works that we explained it. In any case, Rickert was a member of the Band of the Falcon from before. So much like Guts was shocked when Goldberg came out and said, as a member of the Band of the Falcon, I'll be fighting you, I'll be your opponent. Rickert is surprised to see these guys bring that flag. And he's like, wow, well, you know, actually, I was part of the real Band of the Falcon long ago. And that is kind of, it's the old meeting the new, in a way.
Yeah. It's like new fans of a band and you whip out your concert t-shirt from 1978. And you're like, I was there on their first tour. And they're like, oh, wow, this guy really knows his Metallica.
And it's more like, I was there before they sold out.
Yeah, I was there before Black Album, you pussies.
It's like, I'm not really a fan anymore now.
Not yeah, yeah, why would I be after that shit? If Griff is still listening, he'll appreciate that.
Yeah.
So the big thing I wanted to talk about this episode was the Wingstones.
Of course.
Yeah, so I wish I could explain it in really simply what I think is cool about the Wingstones, but I might be able to now. If you've been listening to the mini podcast, Aziel and I brought these up on one of the splatter platters. And if you don't know what a splatter platter is, go subscribe to Patreon. We have lots of splatter platter mini podcasts that are very fun. In one of them, I had asked Aziel what his impression was of the Wingstones when he first saw it. And I think the key thing to understanding the Wingstones is like this. The tree itself could have just been the reason that creatures are repelled. That could have been it. It could have just been the trees there. Thus, the creatures, it gives off an aura of protection, right? You see the wheat fields and everything. You could just say that that's it. Case closed. Creatures don't come near it because it has this aura. It's an invisible aura. And Mira thought to himself, that's not enough. It needs to be physical. I want it to be physical. I want it to be a real thing. And so he chose these crystal Wingstones to kind of emerge from the ground. It's like this extra element that he chose to add. And it does a couple cool things. At first, it reestablishes, as if it needed to be established, that Griffith is the God King here. You know, his influence even goes geological in this world, right? His swings are here protecting the people from the creatures. But also for readers, it makes the world seem so much more fantastical because these were things that were not there before. And it's a way of visually cueing in that this is a new world. Beyond just, yes, there are monsters, but it's a cue that the world is transformed. It's a visual reminder that things are very different now, and to alter your expectations for what's coming. So that, to me, is what's cool about the Wingstones. It's like Mira's tipping his hat a little bit and saying, like, this is a new world with totally fantastical possibilities. So I love the Wingstones. I love the idea of them being a crystallized thing that could probably, again, from a simpler writer, someone with a more simple mind like myself, I would have never thought of Wingstones. I would have said, the tree's there. The tree is protecting you. And that's all there is to it, you know. But Mira thought a little bit further about that.
Yeah, and I guess what's not what you're not saying here is that they would have played a role later on. We don't
know
what exactly, but it's not like it's just to be cool. Of course, there's that aspect where when Rickard sees them, he's like, oh, these weren't there before. So it's like the landscape has changed. It's drastically different. And we also know that they emanate from the tree because they all point towards the tree.
Point away from the tree.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah. They emanate from the tree, if you want. But yes. They are like, you know, radial lines from it. And not the city itself, which is also an indication of something. But yeah, the idea was, they would have probably played a role later on. We don't know exactly what that is. But that would have been interesting. So, yeah, why not?
Well, Shirake finds the right resonance and she breaks them all, shatters them all. That's what's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing, but there might have been more to them than that. Even so, you know, it's like they repel other creatures. How do they do that? Do they store some kind of energy? Do they have some kind of properties? Lots of questions one might ask about these. So it's and of course there's a tree itself, the worst pile tree, which is we are told and shown that it can produce these bountiful harvests all year long, but it has so many other properties, and that's also something that was barely scratched. And it, of course, dominates the landscape completely in this case. So, yeah, just stuff that we get a touch here, we got a touch there, but very, very promising for the rest of the story.
We got a little bit more about this phenomenon that we're seeing, this constant harvest season that we see in this episode that Rickard comments on, that it's always harvest season. Raban comments on it, it's always harvest season here. Gedflin in volume, I want to say 39, I guess two forward from now, not that far from now, will also comment on it. Basically, it's the eye of the storm. It's the storm being the tree's influence. The eye would be the calmest place. This is the one with the most mild spiritual power in this area.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is, of course, how it can kind of like people can benefit from that otherwise tumultuous state of things.
Yeah, the tree is responsible for Fantasia, but near it, its mild power is basically beneficial to people. So clever for Falconia to be set there.
Yeah. A couple other stray things I wanted to say. There's this tiny little panel right as Irvine transformed, passes Rickert's tent. He kind of has like this, they kind of share an exchange a little bit. But right below that little exchange, you can see that the horses are kind of freaked out by Irvine. The horses are like, I don't want to be near this dude.
Yeah.
Well, what I like about that is that the animals get it. The animals get it. And the humans are the ones that are blind to the scenario here. The humans think this is not a predator. This thing's not going to eat me. It's here to protect me. Animals know better. The animals know.
Well, I mean, Erica also says she's scared, though. So I think
that's true.
There is that natural reaction. What's interesting is that the soldiers, for example, they've become used to it. So they are cheering like, Irvine, Irvine, Archer, the demon bow, Irvine, the great Irvine. And it's like, well, if you guys are lost in the forest, you might get an arrow to the neck. This guy's a predator, and you're the prey as well. It's not just a cockatrice. You guys are all prey,
The shot of the forest as Raban and Rickert are talking. There's a shot that looks straight out of Clifforth. Azealia mentioned it during her summary, but I think it's a really important panel because we haven't gotten too many glimpses quite like this that solidify just how different the landscape itself is from the one that we know and are familiar with. Even this whole two-episode section doesn't really quite delve into that, what the outlying areas look and feel like and are how they are lived in. You really just have a panel like this to kind of extrapolate from.
Yeah.
That there really are wild, dangerous creatures lurking in the darkness worldwide. And, it's up to you to intuit what that means for humans, right? I think it's pretty clear from this episode, but it says a lot. Just around these corners where this safe zone that they've created is, are deadly creatures, That's a dramatic shift that I think Miura is almost frustratingly not bringing into focus.
What?
It's there. It's right there. What do you didn't know it was there, but he doesn't really like put his camera right there.
Yeah, that's because he was keeping that for gut. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Obviously, like the full-fledged experience of navigating that new world would have been left to, I think, Guts and his friends returning to the world and being like, wow, what the fuck? Where are we again? This used to be there and now it's here. So experiencing that, and of course, I mean, that's going a bit ahead of myself, but later on, the places that would have been terraformed in a way by Griffith's people and made into a kind of like the kind of country he wanted it to be. So that would have been very interesting to have that experience of Fantasia and then crossing over into the lands controlled by Falconia and Griffith and seeing what that would be like, because I feel like that would have been very, very different. It always reminds me of the Hobbits returning to the Shire after destroying the ring in Lord of the Ring, now it's ruled by Saruman, and it's like crazy. It's like industrialized Britain, and they don't even recognize it, and the buildings are all different. And I always feel like this kind of culture shock, going like, what's going on? I always feel like that would be something like that, but of course, with Mira's secret sauce.
Yeah. And that's unfortunately left to our imagination, because I don't think that kind of thing will be explored. Even if it does get explored, it's not going to be to our liking.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's, unfortunately, that's never happening.
Yeah. Two more things I wanted to talk about, which are the translation. Some kind of minor discrepancies, but like, I don't know, not minor to me. Probably to the average reader, it's kind of like, who cares? I get it. But like, I'm going to focus on two lines. One, when they're talking about the Wingstones, you know, number one Wingstone fan over here, any discrepancy is a discrepancy worth mentioning. Dark Horse says, this is Raban talking, they seem to protect against evil. Thanks to them, the monsters can't get close to Wyndham. The Skullknight.net translation from Puella says, they seem to work like some kind of talismans that prevent monsters from approaching Wyndham. So two notes here. First, they definitely don't protect against evil, because if they protect against evil, then Apostles and Griffith would be nowhere near anywhere, right? I mean, they wouldn't be able to get through the Wingstones. They'd get a sudden headache and pass out, right? Or whatever happens when you get near a Wingstone. So it's not evil. There's something else happening that's specific to astral creatures. I don't know what it is. The next is this line. Oh, the second thing on that line is they mentioned Wyndham. And it's interesting that Raban actually kind of corrects himself towards the end of the episode. He said, Wyndham, I should say Falconia. And I think that's just like a clever thing Mira does, that he's like, he's correcting Raban, but he knows it's Falconia. It's a way of revealing it to Rickard, because as soon as Raban says Falconia, it means something to Rickard. You know, he gets it. He says Falconia. You know, he gets it's the big reveal, and it happens with him seeing the city. So I thought it was interesting that they're mentioning Wyndham, and in my head I'm like, Wyndham doesn't exist, dude. What are you talking about? There's no more Wyndham. He got stomped.
Sure, but it also makes sense from Raban's perspective as a...
Yeah.
I mean, even a noble, and it might have even been part of the royal family to some extent, you know, as kind of a side branch. The same way he also talks about Midland. This isn't Midland anymore. And I feel like this also, of course, I fully agree, it's very clever of Mira to do that, to have him be like, Wyndham, yeah, Falconia. So it's like, oh, no, it's Falconia. It's very clever, but I think it also fits the character, basically. And
it's still new. It's a new transition still.
Yeah, and I feel like even for him, we didn't get to see him realizing that it's not like Princess Charlotte is going to be the ruler of this place. It's Griffiths. I mean, the land itself was remade in his image, the city in his image. And I think I once joked that even the throne Charlotte is sitting on is actually like a Falcon-themed throne. So it's pretty clear who the throne is for, you know? So you've got that whole aspect, and yeah, it is quite clever. And to go back to Wingstone stuff, yeah, the Japanese text talks about mayoke, which means a talisman, an amulet, a charm that protects against evil spirits, evil creatures. So that is what it's referred to as a talisman that protects against monsters. Monsters in this case, mamono, pretty common word in Japanese. So yeah, protect against evil is not a great way to put it. At the same time, it's also Raban's perspective, so
yeah,
he doesn't know better.
I took that into account, but if you are an average reader, I think there is this inclination to explain away Griffith. I see this all the time with newer readers, that Griffith is doing all these new things, all these great things for people. He made the city. He's protecting these people. He's not evil. Evil just means the things that eat you all the time. That's evil. They don't recognize that evil is a fundamental force or concept in Berserk.
Yeah.
You know, that is what powers the Godhand. It is what is the Godhand's power, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I agree with that. It's kind of frustrating because it's not like it's super hard to understand. Mm-hmm. It's just that some people are very like literal. They don't think beyond what's told on the page. Maybe it's also because they are not being used to stories that were a little bit smarter than that. Not all stories are, I would say, equal in that regard.
Yeah. The second translation. You want to say something?
No, I was just gonna say one thing that does bother me that I noticed with Dark Horse before, and in this volume it bothers me, is they have this tendency to bold words at random.
Oh yeah, I can't stand it.
I don't know
why. I try to just ignore it.
I don't know why they do that, because thing is, in the Japanese text, sometimes some words are bolded, which is they put some lines, some dotted lines, some dots basically underneath them. That's rarely done, but it's done sometimes. And these, they don't actually bold them, but they do their random stuff. So it's kind of, yeah. I don't like that.
They're trying to emphasize lines so that the line will be read in a certain way. But they're not actors. The people that are bolding this font are not actors. They don't know how lines should be delivered. Straight up, they don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
They're implying how a line should be read. Right, here's a line from Raban. I'll bold the word. They've bolded the word world here. Since then, our kingdom, no, the world has changed considerably. So they're emphasizing world so that the line will be read with more emphasis, right? It's clumsy. You don't need to do that. This is not an audiobook.
Yeah.
The second line that I had an issue with was Dark Horse's version is, so it's the two farmers, old folks talking about the tree, the World Spiral Tree. They say, a bunch of those things, meaning the limbs, go clear over the mountains. And the Skullknight translation is, but this is taller than several mountains. So it's a total misread of the scale of what they're describing. So Dark Horse is describing the length or the distance at which the tree branches go. But the Skullknight translation talks about the scale of the tree itself, which is taller than several mountains, just straight up. So I would ask which one is it, but I think I already know which one it is. Well, I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, I didn't recheck that one, but just on its face, the tree itself is,
yeah,
the branches go up in the sky, high in the sky. So yes, there is no doubt about that. And given that they go all around the world, basically, that this guy could see from far away, it's this doesn't really make a lot of sense for them to be some of them go over the mountains. I mean, yeah, you guys have traveled from very far to this place, and you already saw the branches in the sky that time, so that's not really a question.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, there's always some stuff to nitpick about. If I may nitpick on something, in this episode, they have the soldiers call Irvine the Arcane Archer.
Right.
And I understand why they chose to do that. It's an alliteration, so it's like in comic books, the Scarlet Speedster. But
Spectacular Spider-Man.
Yeah. I mean, the point is that it's not really arcane, doesn't really match the Japanese. Basically, they just say demon bow.
That's even cooler.
Yeah, so
why didn't they do that?
So yeah, arcane is I guess they mean it in an RPG magic user kind of way. He's got the magic bow, but yeah, it doesn't come across the right way. So I was just I don't like that.
Yeah, that stuck out to me too, but I didn't bother looking into what the actual phrase was.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the point is not to nitpick on stuff, and it's not like all translations are always perfect, but yeah, sometimes it's stuff like that. You're like, polishing over the original text, even though it's it makes sense in some cases, in some other cases, it's you lose something in the...
Yeah.
And I think that's one of these cases where you lose the substance of the original.
There's one other aspect of this episode that really stuck with me that we haven't talked about yet, and that is just Raban in general. Raban talking about the past, about how the Hundred Years' War, that sounds like something that's so distant from now because the world has changed so dramatically. He doesn't say this, but he's kind of implying wow, what a simpler time that was. He's not saying those words. But there's this other line after he's describing the state of the world and that Falconia is the lone fortress. The look on his face as he delivers that line, you could just say he's being stoic. He's almost not emoting, but I don't know. I read into that kind of like a sadness. He says it's the sole stronghold in this world where people can live their lives as people. I don't know if that's the exact translation. That's the Dark Horse translation. But it is. It is. He's delivering that line very emotionlessly on his face.
Yeah.
But it's kind of acknowledging the state of the world, like the true scope of things, that there's only one place that's safe for humans,
Yeah.
And letting that sink in is the final line of the episode.
Yeah, it is a kind of a big deal. And I think what he says before is in a way even more telling, that the days of human against human warfare were almost serene by comparison. And I think, yeah, it does carry a certain melancholy with it, where he's recognizing that the good old days are over. Now they're in a whole new place, and They're lucky in Falconia because they've got all this stuff, but I mean, things were simpler before. He's recognizing that it's not like, oh, we're living in a fantasy tale. It's all fantastic. So it's a very grounding commentary, which again, I think shows, Mura's cleverness here because it grounds things into, not everybody has drunk the Kool-Aid. Not everybody is just on board and, yay, Fantasia, yay, Falconia, everything is great. No, it's actually like some things were lost. Things were also good before. It was different. But you could go around and there were bandits and stuff like that, but not monsters everywhere. So Raban is his commentary reflects all of that. And I think that's important, again, to ground this moment and also for the future, because that says it's a very important thing. Falconia being the only place for mankind, the whole other world being hostile. It's an important message that's repeating several times throughout the story. So it's it would have had an important role in the future. This context.
Yep. Not going to comment on continuation's view of things.
Because they've retconned that already. So
yeah, because everything we just said, just throw it out the window.
Yeah.
If you're reading the continuation, and if you're swallowing every word that's coming out of the continuation, then you're just like, the tree's branches don't go that far.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I guess they don't go that far after all.
Yeah. I mean, Raban's wrong. Ged Flynn's wrong. We don't need to go down this path.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's all we have for today's episode. It's a short one, two episodes, but we'll be back in a month to start volume 38, which is another favorite of mine, Rickert's adventures through Falconia and his escape from Falconia.
Yeah, because one thing we didn't mention, you talked about the post you made in 2011 about the fact Rickert might go to Falconia, and I did have an answer to that at the time. I was like, yeah, it could make sense, but only if Fantasia has made his place inhospitable and basically unlivable, which is exactly what happened.
Yeah.
And after that, I was like, but, you know, I'm not sure I want Rickert to be there, because I also think like he might have his perspective might also be useful for the outside Falconia, for like the normal people in Fantasia who are struggling. And what I find interesting is that Mura basically did everything at once. He showed us Rickert and Erika's refugees coming into Falconia, then their experience there, of course, and Rickert's meeting with Griffiths, which was extremely memorable, and then their escape, and then he had planned to show us them surviving the outside world with the back Erika. So it's like we had like all these small expectations, and you put them all together and make them even better, and that's what Mura did. And so it's like, all right, you know, that's why he's
amazing. It reminds me of that thread I made recently where I'm like, I wonder why he did this. I'm just going to run down this thread and just kind of wonder, why did he do this? Oh, that's why he did that. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, that's a better option. Not only did he have the right, not only were we seeing the direction, he was looking like even further, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back in another month with more of our reread podcast. If you have not already, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/sknet. We have monthly mini podcasts, which are basically just like you heard today, me and Azeel going on for 30 minutes to an hour about a different topic every month. And it's also updates from Azeel and translations from Puella from interviews with Mira. Again, that's patreon.com/sknet. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.
The Skullcast is a production of SkullKnight.net, a Berserk fan community. If you like what you heard, please visit patreon.com/sknet. Donations there do not go towards the podcast, but instead toward our resident translator, Puella, who ensures that our members have access to high-quality, text-based translations of Berserk. Puella has also been translating interviews with Berserk's creator, Kentaro Miura. Many of these interviews have never been translated into English, so it's very exciting to read those. That kind of work simply wouldn't have happened without support from our donors. If you'd like to chip in a buck or two, please know that it all helps. Once again, that's patreon.com/sknet. If you have a question or want to comment on the podcast, visit our forum, skullknight.net/forum. Near the top, you'll see a section devoted to the podcast. There's always an active thread in there, so go ahead, leave a post, and someone's sure to respond quickly. Thanks for listening!